The military conflict between Russia and Ukraine now in its third day, Moscow says over 800 Ukrainian military targets are already destroyed. The escalation in Ukraine pushing up fuel prices in Europe while raising concerns about the future of energy supply in the continent. And Moscow summons the Israeli ambassador over the regime's stance on the conflict in Ukraine shortly after blasting Israel for the occupation of Syria's Golan Heights. Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi. Day three of the military conflict between Russia and neighboring Ukraine, with fighting now reaching the streets of the capital, Kiev. The Ukrainian military says it has repelled a Russian attack in Kiev's Victory Avenue. Gunfire was reported near the government buildings, too. Street battle is also underway in the northeastern city of Sumy. Russian forces say they have captured the city of Melitopol, southeast of Ukraine, and that is while Ukrainian forces in the city of Lviv say Russian soldiers are retreating there. The Ukrainians also say they have shot down a Russian helicopter and a bomber and transport plane in the east. The health ministry says 198 Ukrainians, including three children, have been killed so far. President Vladimir Zelensky says the military is in control of Kiev and key points around the city. He has vowed to defend the capital.
I am here. We will not lay down the weapons. We will defend our state because our weapon is our truth. And the truth is that this is our land, our country, our children, and we will defend all of that.
The Russian State Duma speaker said Zelensky has left Kiev for Lviv, but the Ukrainian president has pledged to remain in the capital. Meanwhile, the U.S., France, Slovakia, and the Czech Republic have approved military assistance to Ukraine. French President Emmanuel Macron has warned that the world must brace for a long war. Russia says it has targeted Ukraine's military infrastructure with air and sea-based cruise missiles, destroying over 800 targets. Moscow has denied reports of targeting Ukrainian cities and says it is taking the required measures to avoid civilian casualties. Around 100,000 people have crossed into Poland from Ukraine, fleeing the fighting. The Russian-Ukrainian military conflict is leaving its impact on energy prices in Europe while raising concerns about gas supplies next winter. Wholesale gas and power prices spiked this week after Germany stopped the certification for a Nord Stream 2 pipeline that was supposed to pump Russian gas to Europe. Germany did so to punish Russia over the Ukraine conflict, and on Thursday, gas prices increased by 60%. Before that, gas and power prices already reached a record high this winter due to several issues, including low gas inventories. In the meantime, high power prices were a major power behind the soaring inflation in Europe. Now things are expected to become more difficult in the months to come, especially next winter, in case that Russian gas flows are interrupted. Currently, Russian supplies are around 40% of European gas. Earlier, we reached out to journalist and political commentator Fred Weir for his take on the situation. He believes anti-Russian sanctions will have a disastrous impact on Europe and its economy.
The situation is galloping on. It's becoming more and more dire every day. The reason not to cut Russia off swift, of course, is that it would make financial transactions completely impossible. And especially for Europe, let's remember that Europe receives like 40% of its natural gas and 25% of its oil from Russia. And if it was simply physically impossible to pay, I don't know how the payments work, but they must be like monthly or something. If that became impossible, then Russia would cut off the energy supplies and it would be, you know, nothing short of disastrous for Europe. The United States can afford to push these these measures and, you know, get quite gung-ho about it. But the United States does very little trade with Russia. And so they would, you know, rising oil prices would affect Americans. And they're, I see from the American press, they're really worried about that. But other countries in the global economy would suffer terribly.
Russia has summoned Israel's ambassador to Moscow, demanding an explanation as to why Tel Aviv was against the Kremlin's military operation in Ukraine. Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister Mikhail Bogdanov asked Alexander Ben-Zvi to explain why Israel is expressing support for, quote, the Nazis in Ukraine. The Russian diplomat also said Moscow expected Tel Aviv to understand what his country's motives were for the military campaign in Ukraine. Prior to that campaign, Russia had taken issue with Israeli sovereignty over the occupied Golan Heights. On Wednesday, Russia's deputy ambassador to the UN, Dmitry Polyansky, said the Kremlin did not recognize Israel's sovereignty over the Golan Heights that are part of Syria. And media reports have shed light on new details about the death of a Palestinian activist, Muhammad Nizar Banat. He died in June last year, shortly after security forces stormed his house in the occupied West Bank and arrested him. According to fresh revelations, autopsy reports indicate that there were bruises and wounds on Nizar Banat's body. His face had been pepper sprayed, too. That shows that he did not die in bed, as the Palestinian Authority claims. Eyewitnesses say Nizar Banat was beaten up and hit in the head with an iron bar by those holding him. He was a vocal critic of the ongoing Saudi-led military aggression against Yemen. Nizar Banat had also blown the whistle on the Palestinian Authority procuring and distributing expired COVID vaccines. Moreover, he had revealed that the authority worked hand in glove with the Saudi regime to kill Saudi dissidents. Moving on, Iran's permanent ambassador to the United Nations says the continued presence of foreign forces in Syria has provided favorable conditions for terrorist activities there. Majid Takhtravanchi condemned the presence of foreign forces in Syria as illegal and called for their immediate withdrawal. He said fighting terrorism cannot be used as an excuse to undermine Syria's sovereignty and territorial integrity. The Iranian envoy stressed that the presence of terrorist groups like Daesh in Syria poses threats to regional and international security, too. Takhtravanchi was speaking at a Security Council meeting. He also condemned Israel's continued airstrikes on Syria, calling them a flagrant violation of international law. The Iranian envoy called on the Security Council to take action to stop the Israeli attacks. Tim Anderson is the director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies. He says the United States statement saying that it's in Syria to fight terrorism is just a pretext to prolong its presence there.
Iran's ambassador is correct, of course, that the NATO states have been providing safe haven for and supporting terrorist groups in Syria for more than a decade now. This was admitted by many senior U.S. officials, including the current President Biden when he was vice president 8 years ago, that his ally, U.S. allies, close allies, were financing and arming all of the armed groups, all of the insurgent groups in Syria. Now, so, of course, the pretext to be fighting terrorism in Syria and Iraq has always been a false pretext. On top of that, you have, as you mentioned, the unilateral coercive measures against Syria, stealing their resources and depriving Syrians of access to their own grain and their own oil. These are very serious crimes.
Intensive talks between Iran and the P4+1 are still ongoing as parties to the negotiations try to find a way to hammer out a deal after significant progress.
Vienna's Palais Coburg Hotel, the venue of marathon talks between Iran and the P4+1 group. it has once again become the center of a lot of attention, as parties involved in the tough negotiations have signaled significant progress despite the complexity of some issues. The eighth round, which began on December 27th, has now become one of the longest rounds of talks between Iran and the P4+1, namely Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany. Iran and the P4+1 are completing a draft text of an agreement to revive the 2015 deal. Most of the delegations acknowledge that the talks have reached a critical stage. The diplomacy seems to be approaching a make-or-break moment. Iran's lead negotiator says being near the finish line does not guarantee crossing it. Ali Bagheri-Kani says it requires extra caution, much perseverance, additional creativity, and a balanced approach to take the last step. The Iranian diplomat points out that to finish the job, there are certain decisions that the Western parties to the negotiations need to take.
Thus far, the West has been reluctant to make any sweeping political decisions that are necessary to bring the United States back into the plan. Iran isn't just going to forget the very many U.S. and Western provocations since the United States left the plan in 2018, and they understand that there are many political camps competing at once for power. The West needs to make sweeping political decisions that will definitively outline the future of U.S. involvement in the plan.
Iran says its initiatives pave the way for the progress in the negotiations and that a good deal is within reach in the Austrian capital. Tehran believes that the ball is now in the West's court, and if it shows serious determination, a good deal can emerge.
Some Western parties to the talks between Iran and the P4+1 have warned that time is running out fast. They have tried to impose deadlines for the talks, but the Iranian side has insisted that it will not be bound by deadlines and that is opposed to any fragile deal.
Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi says Tehran seeks a lasting deal, not a fragile one. The president has noted that credible guarantees, putting an end to political claims and effective removal of sanctions are necessary for a lasting deal with the P4+1 group. But what are the characteristics of a lasting deal? The 2015 deal lasted a few years only. Even during the years that the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action was in place, Iran had serious grievances about its implementation by Western parties. It complained that it was not receiving the economic benefits it was entitled to. And Iran seems to have learned a lesson from how the hard-earned international agreement unraveled. Since the beginning of the talks in Vienna last year, Iran has insisted that America must remove all sanctions imposed on Tehran after former U.S. President Donald Trump unilaterally pulled out from the deal in May 2018 in a verifiable manner. It has also demanded that Washington provide guarantees that it will not leave the JCPOA again.
Iran wants credible guarantees from the United States because the U.S. has failed to provide any critical guarantees, any credible guarantees, since the beginning of these negotiations. When the JCPOA was first being planned and negotiated back in 2015, the United States made a commitment to diplomacy and peace. Yet, in 2018, they proved that that commitment was not a guarantee by dropping out after the change of an administration. So what we find is that when Iran is talking to the United States and other Western nations that change their administrations often, and those administrations are subject to changing their positions from the last administration, then you find that Iran doesn't have any solid guarantees.
Iran says America's maximum pressure campaign has failed and its credibility has been seriously deterred. Observers believe Washington now has to take measures to compensate for its past mistakes and regain the trust of the international community.
Moving on. The Chinese president says his country is ready to work with North Korea to develop relations under new situation. According to North Korean media, Xi Jinping has sent a message to Kim Jong-un in which he has stressed the importance of cooperation between Beijing and Pyongyang. The media did not specify what the new situation in the message referred to. Earlier this week, Kim vowed to cooperate with Beijing in a bid to foil what he called threats posed by the U.S. and its allies. China is North Korea's closest ally and its biggest trade partner. South Korea has hit a peak of more than 170,000 new daily cases, an increase of 60,000 per day this week. As the Omicron variant of COVID-19 spreads, the surge jeopardizes plans to open the economy and ease restrictions. With the school term set to begin next week, concerns grow over whether classes should be online or in person and whether vaccines should be mandated. And floods triggered by torrential rainfall batter Queensland State, eastern Australia, killing at least three people. The total deaths are now five since early this week. At least one person remains missing. Rainfall in some areas of Queensland has exceeded records going back decades. Flood levels are also expected to pass levels last seen 23 years ago. Several hundreds of people have been evacuated. However, severe weather is making rescue chopper flights difficult. Meanwhile, authorities in the state of New South Wales have told residents to be prepared for heavy storms this weekend. That is because the severe weather system in Queensland is making its way south. And a powerful earthquake hits Indonesia's largest island, Sumatra. At least seven people have been confirmed dead. Dozens more are injured. Some buildings, including a government office, have been damaged. The quake was followed by over a dozen aftershocks and caused tremors in neighboring Singapore and Malaysia. Earthquakes frequently shake Indonesia as the country is placed in a seismically active zone. In 2009, about 1,000 people were killed by a powerful quake there. And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
The Central Intelligence Agency has secretly been running mass surveillance operations to collect data on Americans, according to a newly published letter written by Senators Ron Wyden and Martin Heinrich. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by John Miltimore Ryder. This article is published under the heading Sick Things We Know About the CIA's Secret Mass Surveillance Program. Here's the story. The Central Intelligence Agency has secretly been running mass surveillance operations to collect data on Americans, according to a newly published letter written by Senators Ron Wyden and Martin Heinrich. Wyden and Heinrich, both members of the Senate Intelligence Committee, wrote the letter in April 2021, and the letter was partly declassified recently. In the letter, Wyden and Heinrich called on the CIA to inform the public about the data collection program, calling for full transparency. This declassification is urgent, the senators wrote. The CIA responded to the allegations in a statement published by the Wall Street Journal. CIA recognizes and takes very seriously our obligation to respect the privacy and civil liberties of U.S. persons in the conduct of our vital national security mission and conducts our activities, including collection activities, in compliance with U.S. law, Executive Order 12,333, and our Attorney General guidelines, said Christy Scott, the agency's privacy and civil liberties officer, adding, CIA is committed to transparency consistent with obligation to protect intelligence sources and methods. The allegations from Wyden and Heinrich are serious, but the extent of the danger and severity is clouded by several factors, not the least of which is the fact that the letter is highly redacted. Here are a few important takeaways. Number one, laws prohibit CIA spying on Americans. As Politico noted, the CIA is largely prohibited by law from engaging in domestic spying, which makes the revelations troubling. But as the Wall Street Journal reports at times, intelligence agencies have found ways to circumvent these prohibitions, noting that some U.S. intelligence programs collect broad streams of internet or telephone data in a way that can scoop up information on Americans, such as when someone is communicating with a target of surveillance who lives overseas. This is known as incidental collection, and it's an issue lawmakers in both parties have flagged as a violation of civil liberties and personal privacy. Number two, the nature of the surveillance is unclear. Several publications have pointed out that the nature of the surveillance isn't really clear. Yet the language in the redacted letter suggests the program involves non-traditional surveillance, noting data collection is done in bulk and uses backdoor searches of Americans, the same issue that has generated bipartisan concern in the FISA context. As the ACLU says, this implies the spy agency may be vacuuming up vast amounts of information to spy on Americans and storing it indefinitely. Number three, the surveillance is warrantless. While the nature of the surveillance is murky, Senators Wyden and Heinrich make one thing clear. The information being collected is warrantless, meaning the data are being scooped up without a warrant. This directly violates the Fourth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, which states the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures, shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue, but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. And number four, the program appears to be unlawful. While what constitutes spying is debatable, but Wyden and Heinrich suggest that the program may have exceeded its lawful bounds. While the senators don't use the words unlawful or illegal, they suggest the program may be just that, noting it falls entirely outside the statutory framework that Congress and the public believe govern this collection. What the precise statutory framework is isn't spelled out here, but it's safe to say that Wyden believes that the CIA is acting outside that of a scope. Number five, the CIA is acting without oversight. While there has been a great deal of discussion on the idea that the FBI's visa warrant process is broken, it's worth noting that at least that program had some judicial oversight, weak as it often was. Wyden and Heinrich suggest this is not the case with CIA's data collection program, which they say operates without any of the judicial, congressional, or even executive branch oversight that comes from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And number six, this isn't Wyden's first dust-up with CIA. Finally, it's worth noting that this is not the first time Wyden has clashed with the CIA over rogue operations. In 2016, the senator from Oregon had a heated exchange with then-CIA Director John Brennan over the CIA's improper search of Senate files, including the unauthorized search of the emails of Senate staffers investigating the CIA's use of torture in the so-called War on Terror. Brennan denied the CIA's actions were improper, even though both a CIA Inspector General and a review board appointed by Brennan himself conceded the search resulted in an appropriate access to the Senate's work product, prompting a sharp rebuke from Wyden. In 2013, Wyden also asked Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, if the NSA collected any type of data at all on millions or hundreds of millions of Americans. Clapper responded, "No, sir, not wittingly." It was later revealed the NSA was in fact collecting metadata on millions of law-abiding Americans without warrants. Many thinkers have written about the dangers of bureaucracy, a system in which important decisions are made not only by individuals or even elected representatives, but state officials. The famed writer and traveler Alexei D. Tolstoy saw bureaucracy as the Achilles heel of modern democracy. A century later, the great economist Ludwig von Mises wrote an entire book about its nature and evils, bureaucracy. The tentacles of the U.S. bureaucratic state do not reach as far as those of states in the 20th century. the period in which Arendt wrote, but as early as the 1930s, government reports have warned about a headless fourth branch of the government responsible to no one. That was more than 80 years ago. Now, there is a secret CIA program that has been spying on Americans free from any kind of oversight for an undetermined length of time. This sounds just a bit like the terror Arendt described. What happens next, however, is unclear. The list of U.S. intelligence scandals and improper programs has grown lengthy in recent years, but accountability has been elusive. We will see if this time is any different.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 3, 2016, by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of 27th anniversary of Imam Khomeini's passing. The speech was delivered at Imam Khomeini's shrine in Tehran, Iran.
There are specific criteria for being a revolutionary. As I said, the third criterion is a commitment to independence. Independence is very important. It includes domestic, regional, global, and international independence. We should preserve the independence of the country and the system in all these areas. This means that we should not be deceived in the area of politics. An enemy whose goal is to make governments and nations follow him tries different methods. It is not the case that he always speaks in a threatening tone. Sometimes he flatters you, and sometimes he writes a letter saying that we should go and cooperate with the Americans so that together we can resolve global matters. He speaks to you in this manner, a manner of manipulation. You might be tempted to go and cooperate with a superpower so that you can resolve an international matter. This is how they speak in the discourse of formal and diplomatic correspondence. But this is not the truth of the matter.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The truth of the matter is that he has a plan in mind. He says that you should go and play on the pitch that he has drawn up. And it is the enemy who says how you should play. He says that you should carry out a certain task. Therefore, the ultimate goal for which a plan has been formulated becomes a reality. This is the reason why we did not agree to join the so-called American coalition on regional issues. On Syrian and quasi-Syrian issues, despite the fact that they had repeatedly asked us to do so, they have a plan, and they have portrayed certain goals which they hope to attain. Unquestionably, they are willing to benefit from the power, energy, and influence of every country, including the Islamic Republic, If the Islamic Republic is deceived and enters their ballpark, this means that it has filled in their work table. It means that it has completed their plan. This is against independence. Ostensibly, this is not like a situation when a government or a person comes and rules over the country, to the point that we say the independence of the country is gone. However, this approach is against political independence.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. I want to thank you for bringing me home.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
The African Union early February suspended an earlier decision to grant the Israeli apartheid regime an observer seat, as the issue threatened to create an unprecedented rift within the 55-member continental body. Now, many Africans, including intellectuals, openly rejected Israel's admission to the African Union. A leading Pan-Africanist, PLO Lumumba, says the Israeli regime adds no value to this Pan-African organization.
I do not see any value at all that is added by Israel enjoying observer status at the AU, unless there are certain subterranean political interests which are at play in this particular matter.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Today we are focusing on the attempts by the Israeli regime to infiltrate the African Union through obtaining observer status. Many countries in the continent do not want the Israeli regime to be an observer member of the African Union. There are concerns that the Israeli question is divisive and might divert the African Union from its more pressing challenges. Join us today as our experts give us their incisive analysis on the subject.
African Union stops Israel. The African Union has suspended a debate on whether to withdraw Israel's accreditation, despite growing calls on the bloc to overturn last year's decision to grant the apartheid regime an observer status. Speaking to reporters early February at the end of the two-day summit in the Ethiopian capital Addis Ababa, Senegalese President Macky Sall, the newly elected AU chairman for 2022, said they discussed the issue thoroughly and agreed to postpone it until the next summit in 2023.
Moussa Faki Mahamat, the chairperson of the African Union Commission, granted the Israeli regime the accreditation last July. Now, several member states, particularly Algeria and South Africa, vehemently protested Mahamat's decision, saying they had not been consulted on the move. Here is South African President Cyril Ramaphosa objecting to the unilateral move to grant the Israeli apartheid regime observer status at the African Union.
With regard to the admission of Israel as an observer at the AU, we've expressed our deep concern about that, because it's a decision that was taken by the chair of the commission and without consulting the member states. Certainly we were not consulted. We have views because we are concerned about what is happening in Palestine.
To discuss this subject, we contacted Khalid Barakat, a Palestinian writer, journalist, and activist. Welcome to our program today.
Thank you for having me.
We also have with us here today Tunde Osazua, a member of the Africa team at the Black Alliance for Peace. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, gentlemen, for your time. Now, let's start off with Mr. Barakat. Now, why is the Israeli regime desperate in its attempts to infiltrate the African Union and is even ready to use unorthodox means to achieve its objectives?
Actually, Israel policies towards Africa is not new, and that is to dominate and be able to influence Africa in favor of U.S. and Israel interests. In particular, if we go back to, for example, the 1960, Ben-Gurion have presented a plan for Charles de Gaulle and in France to stay in Algeria, and if they have to leave, to at least leave some kind of a settler colonialist state in Algeria along the Mediterranean shores. Israel history with Africa has always been a history of domination and divide and rule, and also to they are a very divisive factor in Africa unity.
Now, Palestinian Prime Minister addressed the African Union early February and said Israel should never be awarded for its violation and for the apartheid policies it imposes on the Palestinian people.
Based on your historic stand and your support for the Palestinian right and the relevant decisions of the United Nations and previous African Union assemblies, we call for the withdrawal and objection of Israeli observer status at the African Union. We believe that granting Israel observer status at the African Union is undeserved reward. This actually a reward that encourages Israel to continue violating international treaties, breaching all agreements with us. With this reward, it gains impunity and accountability. I am confident in your inner wisdom and judgment. The African Union has constantly resisted colonialism and apartheid. It has continued, rejected, and condemned Israeli discriminatory policies and practices. The time is right to condemn Israel for its crimes of persecution and apartheid.
Now, Mr. Osazua, will the attempts by the Israeli regime to infiltrate the African Union weaken the resolve of this continental body in its support of the freedom of Palestine?
Well, Palestine continues to win the legitimacy war, one that can only be achieved through real grassroots solidarity, global solidarity. So, you know, U.S. vetoes at the U.S. UN Security Council can try to shield Israel from accountability for its military occupation and war crimes, but they hardly do enough to give Israel the legitimacy that it has long coveted. And it's precisely this factor that explains Israel's keen interest in transferring the battlefield to Africa and other parts of the global south. Another driving force behind Israel's decision to return to Africa is not just about political opportunism and economic exploitation.
The African Union has over the years been unflinching in its commitment to the decolonization and liberation of Palestine. Most members of the African Union object to Israel's illegal occupation, unjust oppression of Palestinians, and annexation of their land. The Israeli regime remains unpopular among the people of Africa, yet there are still attempts to push for Israeli observer status in the African Union. What's the reason behind this push?
Absolutely. It is contradictory. And also, there are powers in the region that is pushing for such thing. We know that this, at the end, is maintaining certain ruling class in Africa and in the region, including the Arab world. We see, for example, that immediately after the signing of the normalization deals between Israel and the United Arab Emirates, and we know that, you know, United Arab Emirates in particular, they have an investment in Africa of over $40 billion. They're trying to utilize this in order to help their new partners and allies, Israel, to also have a presence in Africa. Let's just remember that Israel today have also military bases in Africa. They are, you know, their nuclear submarines is roaming in the Red Sea and the Mediterranean.
While Africa has to face several challenges, from terrorism to the management of military takeovers, the thorny question of granting the Israeli regime observer status now risks disrupting African unity and diverting the continental body from its core mandate.
Now, Mr. Osazua, what really drove the chairman of the African Union Commission, Mr. Faki, to unilaterally accept Israeli regime's observer status at the organization without consulting other members?
Yeah, I think we have to look at the neocolonial nature of these states, right? Neocolonialism, as Kwame Nkrumah once said, it seeks to fragment the African continent and weaken African states and institutions. That also prevents African unity and sovereignty. Neocolonialism kind of inserts its power to subordinate the aspirations for pan-African consolidation. So, you know, despite the principles or the stated principles of organizations like the Organization for African Unity and its successor, the African Union, they haven't really been able to realize the two most important principles of pan-Africanism, which are political unity and territorial sovereignty.
Well, let's now take a short break, and when we come back, we shall continue our discussion on the Israeli regime's attempts to infiltrate the African Union. Stay with us.
African Union stops Israel.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back to Africa Today. Now, this week we are talking about the recent decision by the African Union to suspend a divisive debate on Israeli regime's observer status. Now, the Israeli regime has previously been accused of being a factor in the destabilization of Africa through sale of weapons to warring factions. A group of UN experts disclosed that the Israeli regime had supplied lethal weapons that have been used to fuel the civil war in South Sudan, which has killed tens of thousands and displaced millions in this poor yet mineral-rich African country. Now, do you think the Israeli regime's infiltration of the African Union will escalate its destabilization activities in the continent?
Israel is absolutely a factor that will only lead to more destabilization of the continent. We know that Israel looks at Africa as a market for weapons. Their sales of weapons have jumped to over 300% in the last 5 years. And so Israel looks at Africa as a strategic depth to it.
The attempt by the Israeli regime to infiltrate the African Union is creating unprecedented division among member states. Is the apartheid Israeli regime pursuing a divide-and-rule tactic in Africa?
Divided rule tactics have been, you know, effective in colonial and neocolonial initiatives throughout history. And so, you know, this tactic that Israel is likely pursuing is allowing them to, you know, continue to build or attempt to build relationships with African countries.
Algerian Foreign Minister Ramtane Lamamra slammed the AU decision to grant Israel an observer status as a double mistake. He warned that it may jeopardize the solidarity that must exist between member states. Will future attempts to discuss Israel's observer status threaten the unity of the African Union?
It could possess a great threat to the unity of the Union. It would also create even issues and divisions amongst people and society. It will only weaken the region and the people in the real national independence of Africa. And there are other alternatives. I mean, for example, Israel does not like the any kind of a strong relationship between Iran and Africa, or China and Africa, or Russia and Africa. And they try to be present there in order to implement U.S. Imperialist policies in the continent.
According to reports, the African Union has formed a six-member committee deliberate on the Israeli question. The committee will include South Africa and Algeria, who opposed Israel's accreditation, as well as Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of Congo, who supported it.
South African Foreign Minister says that despite the chair of the AU Commission having powers to accredit observer status, there was need for consultation as the issue remains contentious.
We believe despite the Commission chair having these powers delegated to him, the matter is of such importance. It's not the first time it's come before the AU, and it was not agreed to previously on two occasions. The situation has not changed. Palestine is not free.
Now, apart from Algeria, South Africa also actively led the campaign to reject attempts by the Israeli apartheid regime to infiltrate the African Union. Now, why is this important for South Africa?
I think it's pretty much for the same reason of Algeria, particularly because it is a country and people that fought apartheid and colonization and racism for hundreds and hundreds of years. South Africa is very important country in Africa in terms of its economy and its influence, and also its moral influence on issues of justice and liberation. And so this is really important for the people of South Africa, as it is important for nations of the continent at large. But when we look at Algeria history of fighting the French colonization, when we look at South Africa, we see that these are nations that have a rich history of struggle and also a very strong bond to the Palestinian people's struggle and to the liberation movements around the world.
The Israeli apartheid regime became one of a few regimes to have strong relations with apartheid South Africa. These two criminal regimes collaborated in suppressing the masses fighting for freedom. South Africans regularly hold rallies to express solidarity with Palestinians and condemn the Israeli apartheid regime. Here is one such rally attended by Nelson Mandela's grandson, Mandela Mandela.
To continuously witness children in Palestine being shot in the back, being put in prison, it really pains our hearts as fathers, as parents, and also as citizens in the Republic of South Africa that have witnessed such brutalities in our past. And we are here today as a family with my wife, my father-in-law, as well as my mother-in-law, to say that we will not rest until we see a free Palestine in our lifetime. And we will speak against the brutality that is meted out against innocent children and women in Palestine. And that is why we are here united as a family today, to charge forward with what Madiba once said, that our freedom is incomplete until the Palestinians.
We all know very well that the Israeli apartheid regime fully collaborated with the suppressive South African apartheid regime. Now, Mr. Osazua, how has this historical fact impacted on South Africa's opposition to the Israeli regime's observer status at the African Union?
Well, I mean, historically, historically, Israel gave political, economic, and military support to the racist apartheid regime in Azania, South Africa, to further the oppression and exploitation of African people in the country. And the international isolation which Israel now experiences was once experienced by South Africa as a consequence of, you know, parallel efforts to implement, you know, apartheid and culturally separatist ideologies within each state. So as South Africa continues to struggle with the legacies of apartheid, it's very important that they reject these Zionist normalization efforts.
While the Israeli regime desperately attempts to infiltrate the African Union, African lives in the occupied territories do not matter for the Israeli regime.
Ethiopian Jews and other African migrants face constant discrimination and racism in Israel. The daily racism against Africans in Israel is institutional discrimination and at every level. Here is one such scene where an African is being assaulted and insulted by racist Israelis.
Now, our last question to you, Mr. Barakat. How is the Israeli regime marketing itself in Africa, while we can see clearly that it discriminates against Africans?
Israel's interest is to weaken all societies and to utilize everything they can in their power in order to market themselves as a natural state in the region. And so they'll use religion, for example, and they try to utilize Judaism a way to claim that history as if it's Israel history. Well, you know, the Jewish people history in Africa and in the Arab world are part of our history. It's not part of Israel history. Israel has been established since 1948 by colonialist power in order to be a base for imperialist power to, rule the region. And so if Israel cannot do it through arms, they'll do it through economy and through other means of influence.
Well, Palestine is always close to the heart of all Africans because of the painful history of colonialism and resistance shared by both sides.
The racist nature of the Israeli regime is so brazen that even international organizations, which have for long ignored this regime, have now come out openly condemning it. The latest Amnesty International report clearly states that Israel is an apartheid regime.
Amnesty International is here today to call on the authorities of Israel to put an end to the system of apartheid it is maintaining against all Palestinians living under their effective control.
How do the masses in Africa view and relate to the issue of Palestine, a land whose people face the worst form of Israeli apartheid and colonialism?
I believe that the masses in general in Africa understand that Zionism has and continues to work against African liberation. Currently, Jewish Africans from Ethiopia serve as cheap, exploited labor and suffer the most egregious form of racism at the hands of their fellow Jews from Zionist Israel and occupied Palestine. There's also the continuing racist treatment of Black migrants from places like Eritrea, Sudan, and Ethiopia in the settler colony. And we also mentioned Israel's history of supporting the oppression of Africans in South Africa, militarily, you know, economically and politically. So I think Africans understand for the most part that historical context and how Israel continues to carry out oppressive, I guess, policies towards Africans, and also like the question mentions, towards the Palestinian people.